thighs. It's somehow hotter because I'm nude and he's fully clothed. Hotter still because he couldn't wait to have me long enough to get undressed, or let me dry off, or even take off his boots. He reaches around and pinches my clit between his fingers, and I come. Oh, fuck yes, let me hear you scream, love. He breathes as I wail through my orgasm. He rubs his fingers back and forth over my engorged clit, faster and faster, until I'm convulsing, mindless, lost to the enormity of pleasure he's giving me. I sob his name. He grunts, thrusting into me with forceful jerks of his pelvis. God, he gasps. Fuck, oh God, grace, grace. He stills and then shudders. A long, low moan breaks from his chest. Then he spills inside me, his hand wrapped around the place our bodies are joined, stroking both of us as he gasps through his orgasm, my own orgasm still rocking me so I'm clenching around him and he's pulsing into me. Forever, I think, riding a wave of pure bliss. I want this to last forever and ever, amen. Stupid. I knew, even at that moment some part of me knew, but overwhelmed by my feelings of euphoria, of being like the lyric from that song, A Bird Set Free, I ignored the one truth I'd seen over and over again in my years of counseling couples. Love can set you free, but it can also kill you. And what a cold death mine would turn out to be. 30. The next few days pass in a blur. Bad Habit is recording their next album, so Brody spends the mornings with me, making love at dawn followed by an hour or two of surfing, and his days in the studio. I hire a realtor and begin the hunt for new digs, which is more challenging than I thought it would be, partly because I have more money to spend than I did last time I was in the market. Boo-hoo, says Kat, without the slightest hint of sympathy when I tell her my plight. You poor, sad, rich person. Talk about first-world problems. You're like the poster child for the 1%. It's Friday. We're driving with Chloe to Kat's appointment at the fertility clinic. Her mood is Terminator meets Predator, with a healthy dash of Hungry Godzilla thrown in. And why are you even looking for a new place to live anyway, when you've got the absolute most perfect situation right now? Ignoring that obvious lure, I chastise her instead. 1%? If I may correct you, Catherine, I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I worked my ass off to get where I am now, I saved every penny I made, and I made a few smart investments along the way. And I'm comfortable, not rich. I send her a pointed stare. I'm not rich either, she protests. Excuse me, pipes in Chloe from the back seat. But California is a community property state. Nico's rich, and you're married to him, which means you're rich. I glance at Chloe in the rearview mirror. Same goes for you, Goldilocks. When you and AJ get married, that is. They'd planned on getting married after the baby was born, because Chloe didn't want to do an aisle march with a baby bump, but I haven't heard any news of late. I'm hoping she'll spontaneously provide some information, but she just shrugs, looking out the window. The money doesn't matter to me. Kat swivels around in her seat to glare at her. It doesn't matter to me either. Honey, I wasn't saying it does. And how do you know I didn't sign a prenup that prevents me from getting anything if we divorce? I'm so surprised I almost drive off the road. Nico made you sign a prenup? Kat turns back to look out the windshield, slouches down in her seat, and crosses her arms over her chest. No, she admits churlishly. But he could have. I would have signed one, too. It's his money, not mine. Chloe sits forward and squeezes Kat's shoulder. Kat, cut it out. Kat turns her head a quarter of an inch. Cut what out? You know what? No, I don't. Chloe looks at me. Grace will tell you. It's called awfulizing. Kat blows out a noisy breath through her lips and slouches down farther in her seat. I reach over and squeeze her arm. He's not going to divorce you if, and this is a big if, you can't have kids. Kat grumbles. I never said he would. Chloe winds her arms around Kat's shoulders from behind and gives her a hug. They sit in silence like that for the rest of the trip to the doctor's office. Every once in a while I look over and see Kat swallowing hard, blinking back tears. She really wants to have Nico's baby. I wonder if Brody wants kids. He said his mother wanted more grandchildren, and he's always joking about getting me pregnant. As I'm pulling into a parking space in the medical building's lot, Kat asks, You okay, Gracie? Sure. Why do you ask? You're looking a little pale over there. I put the car in park, turn it off, and sit staring blankly at the steering wheel. My mind has started to spin. Chloe says, Earth to Grace. Come in, Grace. Gathering my thoughts, I listen to the engine tick as it cools. I look up to find Chloe and Kat staring at me with identical looks of worry. I open my mouth, close it, open it again, and say, I've never, not once in my entire adult life, thought about having children. Until right now. They watch me, eyes wide, waiting. Motherhood is something I never contemplated, because why torture myself with thoughts of the impossible? It was something I couldn't have and didn't want, period, but... I draw a breath. What if the real reason I never wanted children is because I never met a man whose children I wanted to have? Stunned silence. I understand why they're so shocked. I'm shocking myself, too. And following that thought to its logical conclusion, I continue. What if I met a man whose children I wanted to have? What if he wanted to have children? What the hell would I do then? Because I can't. I couldn't. I look back and forth between them. What kind of a monster would want a child she might forget she ever had? Kat's eyes well with water. She whispers, Oh, sweetie. Oh, fuck. I turn my gaze to the view outside the windshield to avoid the look of pity in their eyes. Chloe's hand on my shoulder is warm. She leaves it there a moment, reassuring, and then says quietly, For what it's worth, I think you'd be an incredible mother. I close my eyes against the anguish that explodes like a bomb in my chest. At that moment, a text comes through from Brody. I dig my phone out of my handbag and read it, biting my lip. Date night tonight. !! Pick you up at 8 for an evening of wining and dining. Wear something you won't mind being ripped off your body. P.S. I miss your smiling face, even though it's hideous. Let's go in, I say, and open the door to escape the sudden claustrophobia of the car. Kat is in with the doctor for 2 hours. Chloe and I sit in the waiting room and read women's magazines, which are completely depressing. Every article seems to be about what to do if your man is cheating, how to lose weight, or how to make a killer dinner to impress the in-laws or your husband's new boss. I suppose the clinic couldn't put out New Parent magazine for risk of traumatizing their patients, but every one of those women's magazines is like an episode of Mad Men. Like the women's movement never happened, and the best we can hope for in life is to get married and learn how to make a perfect bundt cake. If I'd known, I'd have snuck in a few copies of BDSM for Beginners to scatter around. When Kat comes out, she looks tired, but she's smiling, which immediately makes Chloe and me feel better. You okay, superstar? I murmur, giving her a hug. Yeah, she says, nodding. She sounds relieved. The test where they injected radioactive iodine into my uterus wasn't a walk in the park, but the doctor said she didn't see anything abnormal from the physical exam, the x-rays, or the ultrasound, so that's good. The blood work will take a while to process, and there's a few other tests she might order based on the results of those, but for now, all I can do is wait. When she stops and chews on her lip, Chloe and I prompt, "What?" She sighs. "She wants to check Nico's sperm." I burst out laughing. "I'll bet she does. The old-fashioned way." Chloe elbows me in the side, but Kat waves her hand in the air like she'd expect nothing less. "Under a microscope, pervert, to see if his swimmers are strong or lazy." The thought of Nico Nix with lazy sperm is too much for Chloe, who goes beet red and puts her hands up in surrender. "Discussing the state of your husband's semen is where I draw the line, my friend." I say to Kat, "I guess this means you're going to have to tell him sooner rather than later." I link my arm through hers, Chloe does the same on Kat's other side, and we head toward the clinic doors. "Yep," says Kat, wearing a brave smile. "As soon as I get home. And then I'll do a little sperm testing of my own, if you know what I mean." She makes lip-smacking noises at Chloe, who makes a face and mutters, "Gross." Kat and I grin at each other. Some things never change. By the time 8 o'clock rolls around, my nerves are wound so tight I might snap. I've spent all afternoon thinking about the future, a dangerous proposition I rarely allow myself to indulge in. When the doorbell rings, I jump, sloshing the wine in my glass. Fortunately, it doesn't spill. I down it in one big gulp and go answer the door. Brody stands there, freshly shaved, with perfect hair and a smile that could bring world peace. "Hello, beautiful," he murmurs, letting his warm gaze travel over me. "Hello, beautiful yourself," I reply, wowed by the incredible dark blue suit he's wearing, perfectly cut, obviously custom-made. He looks like a duke. "Is that chiffonelli you're wearing?" Brody cocks his head. "How could you possibly know that?" I don't bother to tell him that I once had a torrid affair with a famous architect who was so obsessed with a Besoque Paris suit maker that he owned over 300 chiffonellis and built his entire house around his closet. Instead, I say breezily, "It's in the cut of the shoulder." "Hmm." Brody's smile quirks up on one side. "Well, whoever he was, I hope you broke his heart." I grin at him. "That is what heartbreakers do, darling." He steps over the threshold and takes me in his arms. "Darling, is it?" he murmurs, gazing down at me with fire in his eyes. "I like. So formal. Very James Bondy. And may I say you look like a Bond girl in this dress? Muy sexito." I tilt my head to give him better access as he brushes his mouth down my throat. His lips skim my skin, leaving a trail of sparks behind. If Magda hears you butchering her language like that, she'll probably poison your breakfast. His arms tightening around me, he inhales against my neck. "I've been expecting it for years. You smell incredible." "Thank you. It's Clive Christian." Brody chuckles, kisses my collarbone, and looks at me. "Of course you'd wear the world's most expensive perfume." Now it's my turn for lifted brows. "And how could you possibly know that?" Grinning now, he quips, "It's in the cut of the shoulder." "Ah. Well, whoever she was, I hope she broke your heart. Although it doesn't appear that way since your ego seems perfectly intact." Brody looks deep into my eyes. His smile fades. "No one's ever broken my heart, because no one's ever had it. Until now." My heart thumping, I wind my arms around his neck and kiss him. When we finally break apart, we're both breathing hard. Brody says, "If we're gonna do dinner, we'd better go now, because I'm about 2 seconds away from turning this beautiful dress of yours into a pile of shreds." "You already did that with one of my dresses, Kong. If you keep it up, I'll be buying a new dress every day." He grins at me. Or you could just walk around naked all the time and save me the trouble. I kiss him lightly on the lips and smile. You wish, Buster. Let's go eat. I'm looking forward to this wining and dining you've promised me. He kisses my hand and leads me out the door. His car, a sleek black Tesla, is parked in the driveway of the guest house. He opens the passenger door for me, lends me a gentlemanly hand as I settle in, and then jogs around to the driver's side and hops in, slamming the door behind him. Seatbelt, he directs sternly when he sees I haven't fastened it. Yes, sir. I offer him a solemn salute and then do as he's instructed. When he's satisfied I'm all belted up, he clips in his own seatbelt and starts the car. The electric engine's utter silence makes me laugh. Now that's a really unsatisfying lack of noise. I thought all you bad boy musician types liked some macho rumble under the hood. Rhodey's smile is bright in the dim interior. Oh, I've got some macho rumble under my hood, Slick, and you know it. He winks. Laughing, I roll my eyes. You're unbelievable. No, I'm adorable. And charming. And completely irresistible. Stop me if I'm wrong. I go all clinical psychiatrist on him. Oh no, please continue. As a case study in derangement, you're fascinating. Your state of delusion is unusually acute. If I write a paper on your particular pathology, I'll probably get famous. But don't worry. I'll only refer to you as Patient B, so you can continue living in Crazy Town in total anonymity. Grinning wider, Brody drives past the gate and out onto PCH and guides the car into traffic. Just admit it, Slick. You're madly in love with me and you want to marry me and raise the octuplets on a ranch somewhere in Montana, where I'll be a farmer and you'll dress the kids in hideous matching outfits you sewed yourself. Heat flashes over me first, followed by a chill. He just worked the words love, marry, and kids into one sentence. I try to form a pithy response, but can't because my nervous system is too busy having a meltdown. When I don't respond, Brody glances over at me. Oh, he says. I see I've hit a nerve. I won't joke about that stuff if you're uncomfortable. It's just that I don't sew, I say, staring straight ahead. After a few moments, I chance a look at him. He's staring back at me with an expression of surprise, hope, and fierce devotion. His voice husky, he asks, "What about the rest?" My pulse is flying. It feels as if I'm on the verge of a heart attack. "You should probably keep your eyes on the road." He sends a cursory glance at the highway in front of us and then looks back at me. "Answer the question." "Don't answer the question. You're smarter than this. Love is a myth, Grace. Love is just hormones. Love is the root of most of the misery in the world. You can still save yourself." Then the memory of Barney's solemn, soulful words at the housewarming party inconveniently pops in. "Love is the only thing that matters. Love is everything." God damn it. I hate being this conflicted. Life was a hell of a lot simpler before this gorgeous complication named Brody Scott showed up. My heart and my brain warring, I finally say, "I can't really see you as a farmer." Brody warns, "Grace," in a low, throaty growl. He reaches over and squeezes my hand. "Don't be such a fucking mouse. You're a lion. You're a tiger. You were given this life because you're strong enough to live it, remember? So why don't you prove it for once?" Well, hell, leaping off cliffs seems to be what this relationship is all about. I think 8 kids is about 6 too many. Brody pulls off onto the side of the highway so fast, I gasp in surprise. When we're stopped on the shoulder with a cloud of dust settling around the car, he yanks up the parking brake, turns to me, and takes my face in his hands. "You're in love with me. You want to marry me. You want to have my kids." He says it like a demand for confirmation, staring right at me, nose to nose. Instantly regretting what I've done, I shake my head. No, that would be insane. No, that would be beautiful. It's impossible, and yet it's what we both want. My heart stalls out and then takes off again like a rocket. You know I do. You know how I feel. I'm yours if you'll have me. He kisses me, his grip on my face caressing. Oh God, this is crazy. What am I doing? I need to put the brakes on this. I can't do this to him. I groan his name against his mouth. My memory. You need a woman. Someone normal.
I need you. He interrupts in a tone of finality. And I talked to someone about the memory thing. A guy I know. He's a specialist.
You talked to someone about me? I say, horrified.
I didn't mention any names. I just said I had a friend.
Brody replies gently, stroking his thumbs over my cheeks.
This guy is the best, Grace. I want you to look up his background. You'll see he's legit. I want you to see him. I think he could help us.
Us, he says. Not you. Us. I put my face into the shoulder of Brody's perfectly tailored, monstrously expensive suit and concentrate on breathing in and out. Brody says softly,
You're everything I've ever wanted, Grace Stanton. And I'm not gonna let a little thing like your glitchy goddamn brain get in my way.
Gripping his lapels, caught up in a wave of intense emotion, I produce a shaky laugh. My brain isn't little. Then Brody laughs too.
I know. I could tell by the size of your head. You can never find a hat that fits you, can you, Sputnik?
We sit in his silently running car on the side of the Pacific Coast Highway, holding each other and laughing, the girl with a glitchy memory and the boy with an unnamed guilt, thrown together by chance, now held fast in the clutches of the ruthless terrorist that so perfectly blinds young and old, rich and poor alike. Hope.
31. Brody. Dinner is dinner. It's food. The restaurant is in Malibu, so celebrities are crawling all over the place like cockroaches, but I couldn't tell you who was there or what they wore or anything. All I can tell you is that I'm in love. I'm in love. And I flat out don't deserve her, which is probably obvious to anyone who gives us even a passing glance. Yeah, okay, I'm not a bad-looking guy, I've got money, and I'm in this band that's kind of a big deal, but none of that means shit compared to who she is. The reality of who and what Grace Stanton is would melt the heart of even the most zombified, frostbitten White Walker George R.R. Martin could ever conceive. Everyone in the restaurant stared at her when we walked in, and I mean everyone, from the giraffe-necked hostess to the people crowded three deep around the bar to the toy Yorkie sitting on the lap of some overly tan socialite and eating off her plate. Grace just has this thing where she walks into a room and instantly owns it. There are a lot of stunning women in L.A., but I've never met one who can silence a dozen conversations just by entering the same airspace. She's a magnet, drawing every eye, stealing all the light, sucking every molecule into her orbit. She glows. She glows so bright she outshines everything else in sight. And I stand beside her, a fool in a $5,000 suit, basking in the warmth of her light like a reptile soaking up the sun so it doesn't freeze to death from its cold, cold blood. Unfortunately, the dark residue of my guilt is the one thing that can't be lightened by Grace's beautiful shine, but at least it doesn't tarnish her. After half a lifetime of perfecting my sunny mask, my stains are only ever seen by me. You're quiet. She observes. We're at a table in a corner of the elegant dining room. I've ordered wine and the waitress has poured it, but neither of us has touched our glasses. I think we're both in a mild state of shock at what happened in the car. In my mind, there's really only one thing that can happen next. I take her hand across the table and look into her eyes. I have a proposal. First, her face pales. Then two spots of color bloom over her cheeks. No, I chuckle, squeezing her hand. Not that proposal. It stings when she looks relieved. You don't have to look like you just got a pardon from the parole board. In what appears to be a stalling move, she sips from her water glass. She slowly sets the glass down, strokes her thumb up and down the stem, and looking at our joined hands, quietly says, "You'll be gratified to hear it wasn't relief I was feeling." I can't describe the emotion that grips me. It's like a giant invisible hand just reached into my chest and clenched into a fist. I lean closer to her and lower my voice. "No? What was it then?" She shoots me a look from under her lashes, her eyes sparkling. "That ego of yours certainly needs a lot of stroking, Mr. Scott." I ignore that and inch my chair closer to hers. "Then stroke away, baby," I murmur. "I'm all ears." She looks down at my crotch. "Well, not all ears." When she looks up at me, her cheeks have pinkened again. "God damn," I say gruffly. "Do you have any idea how perfect you are?" She wrinkles her nose.
"You keep saying that word, and I keep trying to tell you all my imperfections. You're perfect for me."
That silences her. She starts to chew on her lower lip, and my heart begins to thump like crazy. She's almost there. I can make this happen. I can make her happy forever, and we can both be free. I say, "I want you to move in with me." When her mouth drops open in astonishment, I press on before she can protest. "Now, tonight, forget about trying to find a place to live. Let's move your things into the main house and just do this, for real." There's a vein in her temple that goes haywire whenever she's feeling strong emotion. I doubt she's aware of it, because she'd probably have had it removed years ago. Right now, it's giving me some very clear insight into what's happening inside her body. As if her trembling hand and shallow, rapid breathing weren't enough.
"I
say yes." Her laugh is disbelieving.
"Wow, this dating business is intense. No wonder I've always avoided it."
I can see she's feeling overwhelmed, so I sit back in my chair to give her some breathing room. The last thing I want to do is scare her off when I'm so close to having everything I've ever dreamed of. To lighten the moment, I say, "It was really Magda's idea. I think she sees her chance to double the Brody beatdown team and isn't going to let it get away from her." The waitress arrives to take our meal orders. I watch Grace carefully as she turns her attention to the menu, probing the waitress for recommendations, asking questions on this or that dish, knowing full well she's buying herself time before we return to the subject at hand. She finally decides on a dish. I give the waitress my order, too, and then we're alone again. I lean forward. Before I can speak, Grace says,
"Before you repeat your incredibly flattering, incredibly stunning, and overall mind-bending offer, can we maybe just talk?"
"Talk," I repeat, staring at her. Worry gnaws a hole in my stomach.
"Yes, Brody, talk, like people do, on a date."
Our gazes hold. The sounds of the restaurant seem suddenly loud in my ears, silverware clanging, and people laughing, and the music playing on hidden speakers, delicate guitar chords and faraway violins. Throwing caution to the wind, I say quietly,
"Okay, let's talk. I'll go first. Move in with me."
She sighs.
"Oy."
I make a sound like a buzzer.
"Eh."
Wrong response. "Try again." She pins me in one of her no-nonsense stares.
"Why are you trying so hard to make this happen?"
"Because it is happening, whether you're comfortable with it or not. Whether we put the brakes on it or not. Whether we let our fears get the better of us or not. We want each other. We make each other happy. We're two people who have sown a shit ton of wild oats between us, and there's no reason we shouldn't at least give it a try." She looks down at the knife beside her plate and begins to stroke it in contemplation.
"Okay, that's fair. It's just sudden."
When you realize you want to spend the rest of your life with somebody, you want the rest of your life to start as soon as possible. The look she sends me could cut steel.
"I know that's a line from When Harry Met Sally."
Holding her lethal gaze, I reply, "Why do you think I said it, sweetheart?" After a long time, she says quietly,
"Because you knew I'd know?"
"Correct. This is true love. You think this happens every day? She closes her eyes, smiling.
And now he's quoting The Princess Bride.
I'm irresistible. I keep telling you this. Also, the fact that you recognize every single quote I throw out there is proof that we were made for each other. Say yes.
She opens her eyes, tilts her head back, and stares at me with a challenge in her gaze.
Not to be a killjoy, but I recognize all the quotes Barney throws my way, too.
I chuckle. Keeping me on my toes, I'd expect nothing less. Say yes.
Can we maybe get to the appetizers before I commit to such a big decision, Mr. Scott?
I pick up the white linen napkin on my plate, snap it open, and spread it over my lap. I send her my most winning smile.
Of course. Have some salad. Then say yes.
She laughs loudly, her head thrown back, causing several people at tables nearby to turn their heads and stare.
I just asked her to move in with me, I explain to the fat guy in a purple velour tracksuit at the next table. He looks like an eggplant wearing a blonde wig.
He says, well, if she says no, I'm available. He smiles and blows me a kiss.
God, I love this town.
Thanks, man.
I turn my attention back to Grace, who's hiding her face in her hand.
Her shoulders are shaking. She's laughing so hard, trying to hold it in.
You see, Grace, I have options, but I choose you.
So feels special? She asks between gasps of air.
Exactly.
Well, you're not boring. I'll give you that.
She peeks at me from behind her hand, and I grin. Big.
The Thomas Crown Affair, I say. One of my all-time personal favorites. Now you have to say yes.
She picks up a dinner roll from the basket in the middle of the table and throws it at me. I catch it before it smacks me in the middle of my chest and take a bite out of it, tearing into it with a wolfish growl. From the corner of my eye, I see the fat guy at the next table make a silent O with his lips.
Okay, seriously, let's talk, Brody.
Grace sits back in her chair, smooths her hand over her hair, and then folds her hands in her lap.
Uh-oh. Is this what you look like in session with your patients? Because you're really intimidating right now.
I take a sip from my water glass to moisten my dry throat.
Her smile is mysterious.
Tell me about your family.
I cough, almost spitting water all over the table, but catch myself before it can spray out my nose.
Grace looks at me with raised brows.
Touchy subject? As I recall, you said you were close with them.
Suddenly, I feel as if there's a spotlight glaring down into my face, and I'm tied to a chair in a bare room, looking at a wall of blacked-out windows that's actually a two-way mirror a row of CIA agents are standing behind. It's a good thing I'm not wearing a tie, because I'd involuntarily loosen it, which I'm sure Grace would take as a sign of something bad. Which, of course, it would be.
I set my water glass carefully back on the tabletop and meet her direct gaze.
This is a test, one I'm not going to fail. No matter how many hurdles I have to jump over, she will be mine.
I am close with them. My mom, Margot, still lives in the house I grew up in.
Wait, your mother's name is Margot Scott, like the children's book author?
That's her. Why, do you like me better now? I tease.
Grace smiles.
Actually, yes. Your mother lends you a distinct touch of respectability.
Thank you. Now are you moving in with me?
Her response is a heavy sigh and rolled eyes.
I'll take that as a maybe. May I proceed?
Grace waves a hand in the air, a queenly gesture.
Thank you, Your Highness. As I was saying, mother, Margot, younger brother, Branson, older sister, Bronwyn. Branson still lives at home, even though he's 25, because he's the favorite, is utterly spoiled, and has no reason to move out. Bronwyn lives in Connecticut with her husband and four kids.
When I see the expression on Grace's face, I ask,
what?
Your parents name their children Brody, Branson, and Bronwyn?
I know, it's awful. We would have been mercilessly bullied when we were young, but we were in prep school and everyone else had equally terrible names. My best friend growing up was named Fenton Farnsworth the Third.
Grace laughs.
Was not.
And to God.
I can't believe they even have prep schools in Topeka, Kansas. Isn't that farm country?
Excuse me, but Topeka is the capital of the state, Slick, and very upscale. We even had running water and indoor bathrooms.
Grace smirks.
And here I was picturing you riding bulls and eating deep-fried Twinkies at the county fair.
Snob. Hick. As I was saying, I continue, trying not to laugh, I went to prep school. Then I was accepted to UCLA's music program as a freshman, so I moved to L.A. when I was 18. With Magda, prompts Grace when I pause to take another swallow of water. Yep. My mom was concerned I'd become a male prostitute, or a junkie of some sort, because she'd seen too many daytime TV movies about runaways in Hollywood, so she sent along a spy.
What about your dad? What does he do?
I try, very carefully, to keep my expression neutral. He was a senator. Grace watches me, waiting, as it hangs in the air between us. Was. After a moment, I say quietly, he died a few years ago from cirrhosis. We weren't. I look down and notice my left hand trembling. I pull it into my lap and make a fist. We weren't on the best of terms. In fact, we hadn't spoken for years before he passed.
I'm sorry to hear that, Grace murmurs.
Don't be. He wasn't a good person. It's out before I can take it back, an uncensored confession filled with emotion, my voice as harsh as nails scraping down a chalkboard. To stop myself from adding anything else, I clench my jaw. After a tense moment, Grace says,
Brody?
I inhale a slow breath and look at her. She's staring at me, her expression as calm as a Buddha's. She says,
We'll leave that for another date, or never, if you prefer. I'm a firm believer that the past is just that, past, and the dead should be left to rest in the ground where we put them. We don't have to share the details of our sad stories. It's enough that we're trying to build better ones.
I don't know why, but that moves me so much my throat closes and my chest goes tight.
Thank you.
The waitress arrives with our appetizers, giving me a much-needed break from having to speak. My vocal cords feel raw, like I've been screaming. We eat for a while in silence, alone with our thoughts, until Grace asks,
What's that tattoo you have? The symbols above the angel's wings on your chest? It looks like some kind of language.
My heart skips a beat. I say quietly, Kind of part of that past is past thing. I'd have told her if she pushed me for more, but she just moves on to her next question without missing a beat.
And the necklace you always wear?
I swallow a bite of my Caesar salad and absently rub my thumb over the small silver disc resting in the hollow of my throat, suspended from a leather cord. It's St. Jude. If Grace recognizes St. Jude as the patron saint of lost causes, she doesn't comment. I'm relieved, for a million different reasons, none of them good. I should have known I wouldn't be let off the hook that easily.
Where were you right before you came to the hospital the day Abigail was born?
Jesus Christ, this woman is as sharp as a samurai sword. Panic slams into my gut, making it roll. Sweat breaks out on my forehead. I keep my gaze on my plate and try to answer with a steady voice. Church.
Oh, she says with a small laugh. You were surfing, and here I thought it was something sketchy.
The rolling in my stomach worsens. If I ask her why, it could open up a can of worms. But if I don't ask her why, it would be suspicious. So I'm left with no choice. Why would you think that? With a shrug, she says,
Because you acted so weird when Nico asked you what held you up, like you were embarrassed or maybe felt guilty.
Her tone and expression are nonchalant, but her gray eyes are soul-piercing. She knows. She set the trap, added the bait, and I took it. Feeling sick, dreading where this conversation is headed, I set my fork and knife on my plate and sit back in my chair. I wasn't surfing, Grace, I say, my voice low. I was at church. Real church. Mirroring my actions, she puts down her silverware and sits back. To anyone else looking, Grace appears serene, mildly interested, just another woman listening to her dinner companion talk about nothing of particular importance. But I see how brittle this veneer of tranquility is. That vein in her temple is going gangbusters, and her eyes have turned the color of steel. She says calmly,
Here's the part where you explain why you, a man who said he and God had their differences and that he hadn't been to church since he was a kid, made a stop at a church between an afternoon barbecue and the birth of your best friend's child. Because radical honesty time, that strikes me as very strange. I was so close. I was so fucking close to having her. And now I'm going to open my mouth and it's all going to come out and she'll hate me. It's ruined. It's over. I've lost. I can't lie to her. A sin of omission is one thing, but an outright lie right to her face is something completely different. I can't do it. My pulse pounding, I close my eyes and confess. Because of the accident. There's silence on the other side of the table. When I open my eyes, Grace is staring at me in confusion. I'm sorry, but I have no idea what that means. I'm struggling to breathe. The air doesn't want to come into my lungs. The air hates me as much as Grace is going to any second now. Because after I came back from the bathroom at Nico's, Chloe and Kat told me about your accident, and I... Grace's hand flies up to cover her mouth. Her eyes go wide. You were reminded of your accident? Time stops. My heart stops. The blood stops flowing through my veins. Wordlessly, dying inside because I know she's going to ask me for details, I nod. Grace breathes. Oh, sweetie, I'm so sorry. She stands, crosses the few feet that separate us, and winds her arms around my shoulders. I'm so stunned I can't speak, or move, or do anything but sit frozen as Grace kisses my cheek. She takes my face in her hands. From my chair, I stare up at her, shell-shocked. In a fierce whisper, she says, They didn't mean to upset you. They didn't know you'd been in an accident, too. Dazed, not understanding what's happening, I manage to rasp, What? I know we haven't talked about what happened to you, and it can be another one of those things on the don't ask, don't tell list as far as I'm concerned, okay? I hate talking about my accident. I'm sure you feel the same way, right? I swallow, and then answer truthfully. Yes. Then we won't talk about it. Not ever. Not if you don't want to. I meant what I said earlier, Brody. We don't have to tell each other our sad stories. Fuck the past. Life is in front of us, not behind. The kiss she presses to my lips is so gentle it brings tears to my eyes. A strange noise leaves my throat. My vision is swimming, and inside my chest my heart is starting to break. Because I understand that to Grace, the accident I was in and the thing I told her I did when I was young that I have so much guilt over, that I called myself a coward over, are two different things. Which, of course, they're not.
32. Grace. For the next 3 hours, we talk. About everything and anything, sharing stories, asking questions, getting to know each other better. It's by far the most time I've ever spent talking to one man outside of bed. We're so engrossed in our conversation we end up closing the restaurant. Still, it's not so much the food or the ambiance that stays with me, but the expression on Brody's face when I told him we didn't have to talk about his accident. He looked so grateful I thought he might cry. Of course I'm curious about what happened to him. Anyone would be. But I'm in the unique position of understanding exactly why he'd like to avoid discussing it. Talking about your demons can make them very angry. Better to let them sleep undisturbed than shake them out of their nests. Before we leave, he asks me one final time over dessert to move in with him, and I tell him I'll think about it. But he's persistent and promises to ask again in the morning. I try to convince him I'm not going anywhere, so he should relax and enjoy the courting phase of our relationship, a new experience for both of us. His reply gives Kat a run for her Dramarama title. If you haven't made up your mind in a week, I'll die of a broken heart. I tell him it's too bad he's such a terrible actor because his sense of theatrics is Shakespearean. When we get back to Malibu and pull into the long driveway that leads to his house, I have to smile. This doesn't look like the guest house, Brody. He turns to me, his eyes shining in the dark interior of the car. You're so perceptive.
Besides your enormous feet that are two different sizes, that's my favorite thing about you.
My feet aren't enormous. His smile widens.
Sweetheart, you make Ronald McDonald's feet look dainty. I think Shaquille O'Neal has smaller hoofs than yours. It's like you're walking around on two life rafts.
I smack him on the arm and he breaks out into laughter.
Brody laughing is one of my favorite sounds in the world. I spend the night with him, and the night after, and the night after that.
On Monday I go back to work, wearing long sleeves to cover the faint red marks on my wrists where they're chafed from Brody's lovely sand-colored rope.
I can't remember ever feeling so happy. Or so convinced that things that seem too good to be true inevitably are.
A week goes by, and then another. I work and diligently look for places to live, but still go home to Brody every night. The clothes I keep buying are all in the guest house, but the majority of my time is spent in the main house with him. And Magda, my new fairy godmother, who spoils me to within an inch of my life.
"Eat more,"
she urges me in Spanish, hovering over me with a platter of enchiladas poblanas. Just looking at the delicious chicken, tortilla, cheese, and green chili dish could add 5 pounds to each of my thighs. And I've already had 2 helpings. Another few weeks in this house and I'll be researching liposuction.
"You're killing me, Magda," I groan, rubbing my stomach.
"Save it for later when everyone gets here."
"I have more food for later."
She pokes me in the shoulder with her finger.
"You're too skinny. A stiff breeze could blow you over."
It's little things like this that make me adore her so much. I have no memory of my own mother, but I imagine her like this. Scolding, spoiling, letting me know in a million different ways that I'm her favorite person in the world. Magda has told me I'm the daughter she never had. I've told her she's my second mother. Brody told both of us he can move to the guest house if she and I would like to continue our love fest undisturbed, to which Magda responded,
"I thought you'd never ask."
Which I translated to, "Don't be silly." Brody only smiled. The swell is up now, so Brody's out on the waves for the second time today. Truth be told, I'm glad to have the alone time, because it's the dreaded St. Patrick's Day and I'm in a shit mood. The enchiladas are helping, but from experience I know that comfort food will only get me so far. As soon as the sun goes down, I'm hitting the hard stuff. Before that, even, if the gang ever gets here. Drinking alone always makes me feel like I've failed at life. I push back my chair and rise from the table. "Thank you, Magda, but I can't eat another bite." She pouts. On Magda, a pout looks exactly like a scowl, which her smiles also look similar to. She has one default expression, and that's general disappointment in the human race. I kiss her on the cheek and head toward Brody's bedroom, where I flop on my back on the bed and stare at the ceiling, willing myself not to dwell on the significance of the day. Instead, I think about the appointment Brody made with his doctor friend for next week. I don't want to get my hopes up that he can help me with my memory any more than the other doctors I've seen, but I admit I'm excited. When I read about some of his case studies and his background, I couldn't help but be impressed. I'm still thinking about the good doctor when Brody walks through the door. He's dripping wet, still in his wetsuit. His eyes are red. His jaw is set. Surprised by his expression, I sit up in bed. "What's wrong?" He swallows and rakes a hand through his wet hair.
"Nothing. Why?"
I stare at him, taking in his face and the tension in his body, wondering at the frog in his voice.
"Because you look like you've been crying?"
"It's just salt water, Grace,"
he mutters, stalking across the room. He disappears into the bathroom and closes the door behind him. I see two of us are in a shit mood today. I debate following him into the bathroom, but decide to give him some space and his privacy. I hear the shower go on and wait a tense 20 minutes until it goes off again. After another few minutes, Brody emerges, bare-chested, a white bath towel wrapped around his waist. Moving with his breath, the angel's wings across his chest seem to shimmer.
"I'm sorry I was a dick,"
he says softly, looking at his feet.
"It's not you."
His left hand is curled into a fist. The right one is slightly shaking. "Apology accepted. I got up on the wrong side of the bed this morning, too." He glances up at me, sitting with my arms around my knees, and offers me a sad smile.
"It's okay if you want to bitch me out, you know. You don't always have to be so understanding."
I shrug. "I'm a relationship counselor, Brody. I've seen the best and worst of human nature. I'm not going to bitch you out because you firmly closed a door and took a shower." His Adam's apple bobs as he swallows. In a husky voice he says,
"Well, when you put it that way."
This time his smile isn't quite so sad. I pat the mattress. "Come here." Holding the towel closed with one hand, he crosses to the bed, then sits on the edge. I scoot over to him and rest my head on his shoulder. "Does your mood have anything to do with that nightmare you had last night?" I ask. His back stiffens just enough to be noticeable. I press a kiss to his warm skin, inhaling the smell of him, shampoo and soap and clean, masculine man. "Yeah, I thought so." Brody blows out a hard breath, leans over and props his elbows on his knees, then drops his face into his hands.
"Haven't had one that bad in years," he says, his words subdued.
He doesn't have to tell me. He woke up thrashing and screaming "no, no, no" at the top of his lungs in the dead of night, scaring me half to death. It was nearly an hour before he fell back to sleep, twitching and whining in the back of his throat like a dog. Oddly, my nightmares have eased over the past few weeks, but Brody's seem to be increasing. It's a surreal experience for me, waking up to someone else's nightmare, comforting someone else's terror, listening to the frantic beating of someone else's heart. I've been alone for so long with my own nocturnal visions, it's weirdly comforting to find Brody and I have this awful thing in common. I'm grateful to be able to forget about my own problems for a while and focus on helping him deal with his. There's a faint voice shouting, "Hello, codependency," from some dark corner of my brain, but for now I'm ignoring it. Once I get past today and all its goblin memories, I'll be able to turn a clearer eye to the big picture. Rome wasn't built in a day, as they say. Brody asks, "What time is everyone coming over again?" "They should be here in an hour, unless you want to cancel."
"No."
He straightens and looks over his shoulder at me.
"God, no. This is your annual thing with the girls. There's no way I'm fucking it up. Besides..."
He takes my hand and squeezes it.
"I can use the distraction."
So can I. I haven't told him why it's my annual thing with the girls, but it didn't require an explanation when I brought it up last week. I said we do this every year. He said, "Great, let's have it at my place. End of discussion." Had I known a man existed who was exactly as comfortable with ambiguity and equivocation as I was, I'd have started looking for him years ago. He says,
"Speaking of distractions,"
and pulls me onto his lap. "Oh, so I'm a distraction now?" I tease, winding my arms around his shoulders.
"Now and forever."
His eyes search mine. I bend my head and softly kiss him. "Sweet talker." He cups the back of my head and pulls me closer, his mouth eager for mine. Our tongues sweep against each other. His other hand curls around my hip, rocking me against his growing erection. "I think there's something under your towel that needs some attention, Mr. Scott," I whisper, gazing into his eyes. But he isn't in a teasing mood.
His eyes are intense, drilling into mine. He's not smiling. Instead, he says,
"When this new album is released, we'll go on tour to support it. The label is booking all the dates now."
"Okay," I answer slowly, unsure where this is going. I wait for him to say more, but for a moment he only stares into my eyes, thoughtfully stroking my cheek with his thumb.
"There'll be U.S. stops, Europe again too. Most likely we're looking at 2 months."
I feel a twinge of unhappiness, but smile to cover it. I guess I'd better update my international calling plan.
With sudden urgency, he says, "I need you with me. I can't do it again without you. I won't."
I frown. He's asking me to go on tour with him? Of course that's not happening. "Well, you have to, sweetie. I'm sure your contract stipulates."
"I love you."
He says it like a confession of a terrible sin, his voice raspy, his face contorted in pain. A crushing pressure descends on my chest. It's impossible to breathe. I stare at him, shocked past words. He repeats it again, the words bursting from him like water from a broken dam.
"I love you, Grace. I need you with me. Everything makes sense now that I've found you. I've been waiting my entire life for you. I want to take care of you forever. Be my wife. Marry me. Please."
I'm floating outside myself. My body is a tornado of emotions, pounding heart, shaking hands, shallow breathing. But my mind is detached, clinically appraising with narrowed eyes and a raised brow. Twice before I've had marriage proposals. Both times I laughed. Neither time did I feel as if I were being asked to throw a lifeline to a drowning man. I cup his face in my hands and softly press a kiss to his lips. He closes his eyes. His arms around me are crushing. In a ragged whisper, he says,
"Please."
With all my heart, I want to believe this desperation comes from a place of joy, a natural, healthy impulse to join his life with mine and create a unified future. But there are so many red flags waving in my face, I'm blinded. And today, of all days, fate has a really vile sense of humor. I'm not saying no.
"But you're not saying yes."
We stare at each other, our faces inches apart. His heart is beating so hard I can almost hear it. "I'm saying..." The doorbell rings. When it rings again, Brody drops his head to my chest and groans.
"Oh, they're fucking early."
"Yes, they are, and I'm relieved, because this interruption gives me a chance to get my head together before Brody and I continue the conversation. Something is behind this sudden proposal. Something darker than love. Something connected to... A thought hits me with such force I lose my breath. He knows. Brody knows the significance of this day to me. One of the girls told him, or one of the guys. Of course. Of course he'd know. He must have known all along, since the day of the barbecue at Nico's. So him declaring his love and proposing to me today is... what? My mind leaps forward at lightning speed. In the space of a few moments, I've gone over every significant conversation we've had, every doubt I've felt, every time I've wondered why he was moving the relationship so fast. Does his whole knight-in-shining-denim thing stem from a hero complex? Am I a project for him, a damsel in distress who needs saving? A pity fuck? Or possibly even worse, a band-aid for his guilt over whatever made him call himself a coward? Give the poor girl with amnesia a happily ever after and get a free pass on your own sins. My whole body goes cold. My God, is this entire relationship just Brody's Freudian response to shame? Magda must have opened the front door because AJ's booming voice echoes through the house.
"Hey, pretty boy. Put your pants on, man. Company's here."
Chloe's softer voice follows, shushing him, and then there's laughter.
Inside my head, there's a sound like 1,000 wolves howling at the moon.
I guess this conversation will have to wait.
Brody raises his head from my chest and looks at me. His beautiful green eyes are dark, so dark, and full of